Yeah, I'm a quail. Now, when I'm looking at you, does it look okay, or do I need
Yeah.
to remember to look at the corner of the
No, you're
camera? Am I
fine.
okay looking at you?
You look at me. Yeah, or
Okay,
just
cool.
wherever you want to look's fine.
Okay, cool.
All right, here we go. And we're back, Stripe Show Podcast, on a Wednesday. I'm your host, Travis Fulton. We're going to move up a little instruction here. Usually on a Thursday, we're going to do it on a Wednesday, as we got one of the best joining us from Quail Hollow. And the guy just happens to be on like a serious heater right now as a coach. Boyd Summerhays joining us from Quail Hollow. How you doing, bud?
I'm doing great, Travis. Excited to chat.
Yeah, first off, congratulations, man. All the success. Does winning ever get old? I mean, like right now, everything you touch is like winning. It doesn't matter if it's your 15-year-old son or if it's Taylor Gooch on the LIV Golf Tour. He's won back-to-back. I know you've been his coach for quite some time. Tony Finau, every time he tees it up, he's winning down in Mexico. Your boy Preston at ASU, he's part of Team USA Arnold Palmer Cup. That's fantastic. And then, oh, yeah, Gracie, you have a daughter. She's just happens to be the all-conference out there at ASU. Congratulations, man. You're doing some great stuff. That has to make you feel good.
Oh, I appreciate it. Like you know in sports, though, it's easy come, easy go. And that's why you got to enjoy the good times, because there's plenty of lulls. But it is fun to see the guys playing well.
You know, and it doesn't matter what the skill set is in golf. You're going to have highs and lows. I just did three lessons here this morning. I had a couple more here this afternoon in the studio. And, you know, I got a guy that he comes in. When I started with him, he's probably like a 16. And now he's about a 9 or a 10. He's making nice progress.
Right.
And, you know, he had a really good run there of good golf for like 2 months. And then all of a sudden, here in the last week or two, you know, he struggled a little bit. He's had some things happen off the course. He hadn't been quite as committed. And he feels like he's kind of going backward. He's really frustrated. And I kind of stopped him. I said, look, it doesn't matter what your skill set is. Like, you're going to have ups and downs in the game of golf. You keep pushing yourself. You keep playing with people that have your skill and better. You're going to win some. You're going to lose some. And it doesn't matter if you're a 9 handicap or if you're a +9 handicap like Tony Finau. He's had plenty of his struggles, and right now he's just having a lot of success. It doesn't matter, does it, in golf?
It doesn't at all. I always like to study what other players are doing and saying. I love press conferences and quotes from great players. And Justin Thomas just recently, he'd already just won the PGA. A few months ago, he said, man, golf's crazy. When you're playing good, it never feels like you're not going to be playing good. And when you're playing bad, sometimes it doesn't even feel like you'll ever get it back. So if that's Justin Thomas saying that, and I've heard plenty of other top players in the world say something similar along those lines, for an amateur golfer, oftentimes they come to lessons and they say, I just want to be more consistent. Well, no matter how you get, really what they want to do is improve, because even as they get better, the inconsistency is there, because the top players in the world are inconsistent relative to their best golf. And it's just one of those games that you have to accept that it's maddening at times. It really is. You feel like one day you can't miss, and even the next day, the swing doesn't quite feel the same. And people would be surprised to know that even tour pros, they're always kind of ironing out little feels within their framework of what they're trying to do. But golf is so technical and there's so little room for error that sometimes an amateur golfer can get misled to think that, man, it's them that's inconsistent and the tour pros just feel like they're on all the time. And it's just not so.
It's not. No, I mean, you see a tour pro shoot 74, right? And the next day they come back and shoot 65. Does that mean they're inconsistent? No, that's just kind of their bell curve. Enough of that. We can talk about that bell curve another day. We got to get to your boy, Tony Finau. I mean, he's just playing some great golf. And before we came on, we were talking, you were on the podcast a couple years ago, and it was right after Tony kind of let a couple tournaments slip away.
Yeah.
The Waste Management Phoenix Open, he was right there. Webb came in and got him. The American Express, he was right there to win it, and Max got him in a playoff. And you could just see it in Tony's face. It was like, man, this guy's a world-class player, and he's struggling to put some of these tournaments away. We talked about it on the podcast. It was, I appreciated the candid conversation that we had about a real struggle of a world-class player trying to put away tournaments. You fast forward, I watch this guy on Sunday now, boy, and I'm like,
yeah,
man, this guy, this is a different dude. On Sunday afternoon. I mean, he is in control and he looks like he's the better player. He looks like he's going to win the tournament. He holds off the number one player by 4 shots. You watch Tony Finau now. He's had the lead 3 times. Last 3 times, 54 holes going in the final round. He's held on to win all 3 times. Yeah. You watch him now. What's different, Boyd, in Tony Finau this time around versus the last time we talked?
Tony's one of the rare players that's gotten a little bit better for over 10 years in a row. So we started on the Korn Ferry Tour together 9 years ago, but the year before that, he had made a big jump just to get on the Korn Ferry Tour. And he won Junior Worlds at age 12. He won the Men's State Amateur in Utah at 16. He was a winner. And once you know how to win, it's kind of in you. But at the highest level, people kind of two misconceptions about Tony is he's such a nice guy. He's not that competitive. He's not competitive enough. We heard that narrative nonstop over the, believe it or not, 5 years in between his first and second win. It's kind of crazy to think with all the top tens and the close calls he had had. But in reality, he's way more competitive than people think. He just knows that he plays best when he doesn't show too much emotion. And he is a fabulous human being where he does try to set it. He takes seriously his platform and how he behaves on a golf course. The second is that he wasn't a closer. The truth is the 5 years that he went without winning. Sure. The first couple of losses, some people say, man, he just didn't get the right break at the right time. Or man, if Webb's putt on the last hole doesn't go in, he wins. Or he lost to Xander in a playoff. He lost to Max and he lost to Webb. And it got to the point where obviously it was pretty frustrating for him. He's super competitive, but the truth is time went by and it was just bottom line. We just had to get better, just get more skilled. You're not going to win a golf tournament on the back nine of a Sunday against the top players in the world, like a John Rahm or John Rahm at Northern Trust and Cam Smith in a playoff in his second win without making a key putt from 10 feet and in, 8 feet and in, or getting an up and down. And you saw in statistically last year at Mexico, ironically, he had lost 6 strokes the first 2 days. Super, super frustrating. He birdies coming in to make the cut on the number, and he ends up taking second to John. Well, over the next year, he was a top 15 putter. And when you take a guy that hits it as good as he does, he's going to win tournaments if he's a top 15 putter. And that's why he's ran off 4 out of 18 events. And that was something that we knew that he needed to do, but there was other skill sets that he needed to get better at. He drives it. He's been driving the ball great for, I would say, 4 to 5 years. His iron play has always been a real strength. Bunker play wasn't a strength. Chipping was okay. And short putts we needed to get better at. He's always been great on tour with 3-putt avoidance or lag putting. He has great touch. And so those are a couple areas where he's gotten so much better through the 5 years that he went winless in, where those are some pretty frustrating times. But it got to the point where it's like, okay, this has nothing to do with luck. We didn't get bad breaks to lose to Xander, to Max, to Webb, and these other close calls. It was just we need to get better. So the areas that he really improved on over the last couple of years is wedge play. Every shot he hits in practice, in warm-ups, post-round, and on the course, he's using his foresight, charting all his spins, yardages, launch. He understands all the difference in the lies and what's going to spin more or less. He's become a great bunker player, and he's been in the top 15 in short game 2 years ago. So you saw it on the final round at Mexico. On Saturday, he lost 2 strokes gained in putting and shot 6 under. It was it wasn't a great putting day, but the final round, you look at some of the key up and downs he had. He left the one in the bunker on the par 5, and then he has an uphill lie, 35-yard bunker shot, hits it up 6 feet, makes it. Makes a par save on 8. And you could kind of just see his short game was just as strong as his long game. And when you get so many skill sets, he has length as a skill set. He has height coming into the greens as a skill set. Wedge play now, irons, he can putt. You look statistically, he's a great putter. And he can get up and down when he misses a green. Even if a couple of those skill sets are off that day, he's going to have two or three that are strong. And that's why he, in my opinion, has been so consistent. And even on Saturday, he made a couple key up and downs. He chips in on the 13th hole, and it's kind of like he's really hard to beat if he has his short game on. So I give him a lot of credit where it came to the point where people around him or even fans kind of mislabeled him as, you know, a choker. That word came up, and that's tough to take when basically he just needed to get better on the greens from inside 10 feet. That's what it was. It had nothing to do with choking. Because like you said, you can see he's very, very comfortable in those situations coming down the stretch now that he can rely heavily on his short game, know that it's going to be there for him on a Sunday.
Yeah, the bunker shot on 14, the par five, he hit 3-iron into the bunker. I thought he hit that with conviction, carried it all the way to the hole.
Yeah.
Great spin. The one on 16 was sick. That was a great shot. But that bunker shot on 16, that shot, did he say anything about those two shots after the round? Like, there you go, boy. Look how much better my greenside bunker play is. 14-6. I thought the one on 16 was pretty spicy.
Yeah. Well, and under pressure, I mean, everything's got to be even more on point. But he was, he was 6-for-6 up and downs on Sunday when it mattered most. And last year, he led the tour. He beat Rory out for the lowest scoring average on Saturday and Sunday. You're a closer when you play, and he's always played good on the weekend. A lot of the times where he's lost or taken second, he's shot in 64, 63, 65 on the last day. So it was more that he was just getting too far behind in the first 3 days, but he's always been very, even since his rookie year, he's had a ton of great Saturday and Sundays on tour. And then obviously I feel like over the years too, being on the Ryder Cups and the President's Cups and contending in majors, even when he played with Tiger in 2019, you don't get a bigger stage than that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think all those things added to his comfort level, but it was mainly he just got better in a lot of areas that gave him the confidence. So it was a combination of being in some huge situations, even though they didn't turn out and go his way. He learned a lot about himself in those situations, number one, and got more comfortable, but he's just a far better, more skilled player where he is good at, he's above average in every aspect of the game.
Yeah, you can see it. I mean, statistically, especially with the putting, you know, he's definitely incrementally gotten better. I think he's inside the top 30 now, strokes gained. And, you know, he happens to be the number one iron player in the game too, strokes gained approach. Yeah. So when you can pair that up and, oh yeah, by the way, I can just take it about halfway back and hit it out there 315 in the air, that tends to help too. All right, you got to clear some things up for me, Boyd, because I'm taking a beating here from some people. All right, so you know, when Finau and Rahm get in the final group in Mexico every single year, it starts putting pressure on teachers because they take it back like to here, right? I mean, their hands are literally right shoulder height right there.
Yeah.
And then from there they just turn on the gas and can put on force. These are big men. They can create a lot of speed. They can create shaft lean. They can do all these things. And so here comes out of the woodwork, the swing your swing crowd, right? And hey, everybody needs to shorten it up like Finau and Rahm. If I shorten it up. But the reality is I sit here and I teach people from all over the world. They come in this studio, they get older, they have kids, they play once a week, right? And they're not Tony Finau and they're not John Rahm.
Yeah.
And so I lengthen more swings out than I shorten up. And so I'm always trying to put like movement into amateur swings. And yet the narrative changes when you see a Finau and Rahm to no, it'll shorten up and do less. When you have that kind of speed, right? And because Finau can reach back and go. I mean, I've seen some swings and I've teased with you like, man, I want to see him hit one from there so bad because he would be the longest on tour.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
But talk to my audience about how you teach Finau the uniqueness of him and shortening up his swing, the decision for that versus maybe the masses of golfer listening to this.
So there's a couple things. First, he's 6'4", but he's 6'9" wingspan. So although his swing is super short, he still has leverage. His hands go back very short, arm swings very short, but he's 6'9". And then John Rahm is massive. He's so strong. You look at his legs and just overall, he's put a lot of time into his body. He's a strong guy. If you get up close to John,
he's a horse. He's an animal.
He's a big guy.
Yeah, he is.
So you got Tony with 6'9 wingspan. You got John that's just a very, very strong person. But the thing that gets missed there is how fast they swing the club. A lot of amateurs hear, oh, I got quick with it. I got to be smooth. You look at Tony's waggle. You look at John when he swings. They go back so fast that they're still able to generate a lot of club head speed with as short as it is. So, yeah, John's super strong. Tony's long. He's got an incredible wingspan. But they both have extremely fast tempos to be able to get that kind of speed by the time they get to impact.
Yeah.
But as far as me getting emails saying, oh, I love Tony's swing, I want to shorten it up, I've never really shortened up someone's swing intentionally because they're going to lose club head speed for the most part. That's just how it works. When Tony goes and gets that over 200 ball speed, his swing is a lot longer. The reason why he doesn't do that, when Bryson honestly changed the game with him trying, you know, not trying, but successfully adding that much speed, you know, Rory admitted, hey, I chased speed and it kind of messed up my swing. We tried that for a few weeks, but in the reality of it, he hit it so long as a 16-year-old, but just couldn't keep it in play enough. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So for him to start swinging, Bryson did an incredible job of where his swing pretty much kind of looks the same. When Tony goes to hit it further, you'll see that he gets really across the line. He drops it to the inside. You know, he extends. He stands up, which he needs for power, pushing out of the ground. But he swings way more on a draw path, uses his hands. So it's like if he keeps on doing that, how's he going to fine-tune his wedge game, take the speed out there, stay the number one guy on tour with his irons? It drastically changed his technique. But he was coming from a 200 ball speed as a kid he could get to. So we didn't intentionally shorten his swing. When he was a rookie on tour, he hit so many driving irons off tees and three woods off tees because he didn't hit it straight enough. So in his third season, we had a chat in the off season, we said, if we could develop a fairway finder, he'd be better off hitting that than hitting three woods and driving irons. And what happened is just trying to hit it under control and flight it down a little bit, his swing just shortened up over pretty much overnight. So it's not an intentional move to get control as far as, hey, we're going to take it back short. It was that his visualization was, and you'll see even the final round, look how low he tees it. It's a comfort thing. He's never launched it straight up in the air. He did as a kid, but it always felt like he was going to lose control of it. And so the combination of him just developing a go-to shot was what shortened his swing. But then he realized, man, if I can hit my go-to shot at 180 ball speed, 182, he ended up hitting. He's to the point where he hits driver as often as he can.
Yeah.
Because now his fairway finder still goes far enough to have it be an advantage, but he hits straight.
All right. Two more questions here, 'cause I know you got to go.
Yeah.
So I love that story and how low he tees it. Yeah. I mean, real quick, what is his attack angle with that teed down that low? Is it
so if you look, I tell people, like, you know, when you coach, you're filming face on and down the line, but if you could have a camera on where the ball's gonna go on his, you know, start line, when you look back at the club face, it looks super, you know, teed down low, but the ball is basically at the sweet spot. So he can swing all, you know, pretty much level.
Yeah.
Even at that tee height.
Yeah.
So yes, from an aerial view looking down on it, yeah, it looks like it's way below the top of the club head, of course. But as far as the sweet spot, from looking from in front of him, looking back, it's at the sweet spot. So he's not really down. He's one down to level is all.
So I did this thing, All Things Finau, on Monday, and we looked at his rehearsal and then then into the full swing. And so his lead wrist, okay, like he'll take it back. You can see him kind of hinge it up, and then it's almost like a little loop. You know, the club head kind of gets in behind him. And what I see, Boyd, is that left wrist almost looks like it like unhinges down. Like it almost goes like down into ulnar, and the club head gets behind him, and then he just turns and hits it, right?
Yeah.
Is that something that he tries to feel in his lead wrist, or is it just something, a byproduct of his rehearsal in the swing shape, to try to get his wrist maybe not having a lot of wrist cock, right? And extension, but rather almost on or get it out, like zero it out, almost like putting and chipping and turning and hitting. Is that on purpose or is that just something that he does subconsciously?
So, and you know this from teaching, when someone comes to you and they've played for years, I call it practice doesn't make perfect. Practice makes permanent. So they've just ingrained these patterns over time, and tour pros are no different. When we first started working together on the Korn Ferry Tour, he played with an extremely open club face. So the way he squared it up was swinging really to the left.
Okay.
As the first thing we did was we squared up his club face. But as he did that, you know, he was so steep for so long that feeling steep to him is like, it's rough. And he could only curve it left to right. A lot of the, you know, you watch nowadays and you see the shot tracer, he hits a lot of shots with these irons right to left. And so it was squaring up his club face and changing his attack angle and the path coming into the ball allowed him to hit some soft draws. So it's one of those things where he likes the feeling of being able to shallow it out, but still be on a cut path. So he goes pretty vertical on the way back so that by the time he reroutes it or shallows it, it is in a good position for him to be able to hit either shot. And then, like you said, from face on, he's actually, before he was an open face being really narrow. And so he had to square up the face really hard coming to the ball, not with just path to the left, but like turning his right hand literally kind of
down,
squaring it up. And it's just so much timing involved. He could get away with it up to probably a 7-iron, but after that it became very difficult. So not only is his rehearsal looks like he's shallowing the club, and that's a big buzzword, and but from face on is the bigger benefit, where he's wider because of that move.
Less shaft, just wider,
a little further away from his right shoulder coming down, less lag. And most amateurs, they talk about getting more lag, but Tony, to a fault, had too much of an open face and lag. Well, those are two things that are going to send that ball dead to the right. So, and we try to go in order of equipment. What can we change in equipment to get any gain? Pre-shot routine, setup, in swing. We start with the backswing. If the backswing is where we want it, there could be a feel for the downswing, not a position for the downswing, because it happens so fast. And so all he's doing with that rehearsal is ingraining what he's wanting to keep. And so you'll even see in practice rounds, some people have posted reposted some of the swings I've posted, and it looks really, really vertical going back. Well, he does that in practice rounds as much as he can, even if it looks way too vertical, where the grip end halfway back, when his left arm's at parallel to the ground, the grip end almost is pointing at his toe line. Well, when he plays, it's not quite that vertical. It's still vertical for sure, but and that's a good thing for people to understand, is that, and you know this in coaching, if it's not really exaggerated, no change is going to happen. So he, if anything, gets the shaft even more vertical on a Tuesday and Wednesday before a tournament and warm-ups than he actually does in the rounds. But he's just presetting the feel he wants with that waggle. And he's an athlete. That's another thing, is he likes constant movement. It's about that too. So it is giving it a dress rehearsal for what he's going to do in the swing, but it's that he keeps moving is a big benefit as well.
All right. Final thing.
Yeah.
What am I watching with his putting? Cause he talked about you guys discovered something last week. Okay. Last year in Mexico, he lost two. This year he won five, or he gained five. His hands always driver iron very low. I look at his putting now. His hands are low. The toe is up. I'm not sure I've seen that since Asai Aoki. You know, where the toe is up. What are we watching there? What's the discovery? What's working with this putter?
So it first started with his full swing. When he lowered his hands, if you look at face on from years ago, his face was extremely lofted and to the right. You called open, but it was lofted and to the right, which is really tough for him that was playing with a really open face to even square it up. Now, he needed loft because he's played with an open face as a kid, because in his downswing, he doesn't need the face. A lot of people are teaching a really shut face at the top. If he gets too shut at the top, he already bows his wrist coming down to square it from playing years as a kid with an open face, or even his pro career until really 2000, 14, 15, we really got the face, you know, stronger. But it does, it's not shut at the top compared to what people say would be standard. But when he lowered his hands, it allowed him to aim the face more left. And because by having the face so loft into the right, he had to just keep on turning his wrist down to square it up. And it was really tough to time. So lowering the hands was a way for him to get the face to aim a little bit more left, so he didn't have to square it up as much. Plus, like I said, he's 6'9", or 6'9" wingspan. Lower hands feels way more comfortable, less tension for him. So with the putting, it is really low, but it's the same as his full swing. And yeah, the toes way up off the ground, but once again, if you look from face on, not face on, chest on, but from the start line looking back, so you're looking from the hole to his putter face, he can still hit the same. It's too far, the toe's too far up off the ground. It can't even catch the sweet spot because it's so far off the ground. But it's surprising how far the toe can be off the ground and still hit the center of the face flushly. But it also is a way for him to not aim the putter face to the right as well. So
that's what I thought.
Release of the, not, he doesn't actively, I mean, the face just stays square to the arc in putting. It doesn't open and close. It stays square to the arc, but it does give him the sensation that it's not going to open up as much going back. And that's a big thing for him, is he has a lot less face rotation in his golf swing, but also in his putting. And that's helped him so much on short putts. And because we knew his technique had to get better from 10 feet and in, because most tour pros, they can get this, you know, putting to me is green reading, start line, and speed, and the elements that affect those things, those are the main things. So he always had great touch, but on short putts from 6 feet, 8 feet, how many tour pros are going to really miss their speed by a significant amount? So with the lower hands, it helps him aim the face more square, but going back, it keeps it from opening up as much too. And he's changed. If you look at face on videos, facing his chest, in the past he had so much shaft lean, and that made it really hard for him to aim, but also get the proper launch on the putts too. He was kind of driving it into the ground a little bit. So you'll see those changes in him. Yes, lower hands, but from face on, he doesn't lean the shaft forward. If anything, he likes it to be a little bit back, like Zach Johnson when he putted with that Seymour putter. You could really see his hands were actually behind the shaft. And so those are kind of the adjustments that he's made, is getting a lot of the shaft lean out. That also helped him aim the face less to the right as well. Right. And then the lower hands got the toe up, that also made him feel like it wouldn't fan open going back as well. So that under pressure, he doesn't feel like he's doing anything with the face. Helps his start line.
Good stuff, man. That's the real goods right there, folks, right there on the why, you know, and it kind of fits beautifully and consistent with what he does in the full swing. I thought that, you know, look, he's probably helping him aim a little more left, and that start line's probably more consistent. It's interesting in the net effect of the backswing too, that it's staying more square and not wanting to open as much. So, all right, man, I'll let you go. It looks like Taylor Gooch is joining me tomorrow. He's won the last two LIV events. He's going back home. Tell my audience, give my audience 60 seconds on this man of Taylor Gooch is just playing some serious golf right now. I mean, it's like shooting 10 under every day, for crying out loud.
Yeah, you talk about a ball striker. You know, he's from Oklahoma, and he went to Oklahoma State like myself. Yep. You better learn how to strike it solidly, but also flight it, shape the ball, else in those heavy crosswinds you can't keep it, you know, online. And he is a phenomenal iron player, like arguably the best I've seen. You know, Tony leads the tour and, you know, approaches this year, but last year before he went to the LIV tour, he and Colin Morikawa were 1 and 2 in a you know, iron play. And he's improved his driving, and he's putting it nicely. And he's a tough, tough kid. He's a tough competitor. He didn't win in college. He went to Oklahoma State, being a local from Oklahoma, where most of the people that go to Oklahoma State are the number one kid from the country coming from anywhere to go there. And he just has, like he says, he has that dog in him where
he does.
He is tough as nails, and he's just gotten a little better every year too. I give him a lot of credit. He has consistently just found a little areas in his game where it's needed to be improved. And you could see even the way he closed the tournament out in Australia, he had some hiccups early, but then when push came to shove, you know, he hit the last eight greens and was two under on him. And then he going up head to head with Brooks, who arguably, you know, he hadn't played well for a little bit until the Masters, or the week before he won a live event going to the Masters. But Brooks, for so long, is known as an absolute closer. So for him to go up against Sergio and Brooks in the final round there and, you know, close it out and hit great shot after great shot, it just shows you that the more he's won, he's getting more comfortable. And when he won on the PGA Tour at Sea Island, that's three times he's won in the last 18 months or so. So his confidence is rising too. So he's looking forward to coming into the PGA and the other majors.
Yeah. Well, it's unfortunate what happened at the US Open. I'll talk to him about that, but he will be in Tulsa and then the PGA Championship right after that. Boyd, thank you, my man. I appreciate your time. Congrats. Big fan. Congrats of all your success. Well-deserved.
Thanks, Travis. Continued success to you too. And I had a pleasure being on with you today.
All right.